Welcome to the Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, book clubs aren't just for women, beer makes everything better. I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
And we're the Drunk Guys.
We're the Drunk Guys.
Today we're going to be talking about Ray Bradbury's probably most famous book, Fahrenheit 451.
All right, so here's the synopsis. In Fahrenheit 451, Guy Montag is a fireman. But in this world, firemen don't put out fires, they start them. Specifically, their job is to burn books whenever they are found because books are illegal. At the beginning of the book, Montag has his eyes opened to how shallow everyone is and how unhappy he is. Montag has books hidden away and decides to read them. After his fire company is called to his house, he burns his boss and escapes the city. He finds a group of hobos living on the railroad tracks, which turn out to be runaway college professors who are trying to preserve literature and writing. Montag City is destroyed in an atomic war, leaving the hobo scholars to remake society.
So the book was originally written in 1953, though based on an earlier short story from about 51, called The Fireman, where the idea came from. And, you know, so the historical influences on it are really clear and interesting to see. So first up, 1950s, I think, what was happening in America and the world? Well, we're in the Cold War, the starts of the Cold War. So the nuclear age is among us, and people, I believe by 1950, the Soviets have the bomb. So people live in constant fear of the nuclear attack, right? I remember still as a little kid in the early, you know, 1990, 1991, where it was technically still a little bit of a Cold War.
1980s for me.
Where doing those stupid drills where you get under your desk in case the, like, so you could be melted into the desk when the atomic bomb goes off as opposed to just blown apart in the hallway. Like, people lived with some fear of an atomic bomb happening, especially if you lived in a big city, right? Those would be the targets. This is still almost a decade before the Cuban Missile Crisis, when people would really realize how potential those things were. Mm-hmm. But people are afraid of nuclear energy, of being used as a weapon. Nuclear energy, I'm not sure when the first plant is built to use as actual energy, but it's seen as a very futuristic thing, because it fucking was. It's a, you know, quantum leap away from traditional military weapons, right? I mean, bullets, well, they got better, and guns got faster and more accurate. It's the same kind of technology used for several hundred years, and now all of a sudden, you're harnessing the power of the atom to immolate a quarter million Japanese people. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge influence in the book, and at the end of the book, as an atomic bomb destroys the city, you can see where Bradbury's getting that idea. And there's also censorship in 1950s America. Right, this is the time of McCarthyism and the House of Un-American Activities Committee.
House Un-American Activities Committee.
Because they censored the of out of it. Mm-hmm. People are being called before Congress to testify about their films that they make, and then just to defend themselves in general about their connections to people. And Nixon was masterful at connecting people in this 6 degrees of separation way to a communist somehow. Mm-hmm. Like, your uncle's brother's former roommate once went to a communist meeting, and how can you defend yourself against these kind of things? So people are being forced to censor the work that they produce in film. Also, I mean, and in terms of burning books, just a few years later, the Nazis had huge rallies burning books of things that were considered detrimental to, you know, the Thousand-Year Reich in one way or another.
And so did the Soviet Union, and they were our friends up until just a couple years before this book was written.
That's right. So these things are in Bradbury's head. He's a, you know, literate guy. He's paying attention to the news. And what is a logical conclusion of this? If we just follow along this path, where could it lead us to? Mm-hmm. And the last historical thing that's probably most important for the plot of the book, television.
Right. He's talking about the invention of TV, which was a brand new thing when this book was written. But he's talking about how television made people mindless, that it just became this that television, because it was completely mindless entertainment, that it was sapping people's ability to think and understand or to do anything.
Well, speaking of sapping our ability to think, let's open a beer here. Yeah. Our first beverage of the day is Dogfish Head, one of my favorite breweries. If you're looking to sponsor a podcast, Dogfish Head, it won't be hard to win us over.
Not at all.
Dogfish Head's beer, it's called Robert Johnson's Hellhound on My Ale. So clearly it's about Robert Johnson, and he had a song, Hellhound on My Trail. But the mechanical hound is one of the futuristic elements of the book, right? The eight-legged robot dog thing that can sniff out books that Montag eventually lights on fire. So that's a really powerful flamethrower he has that he could burn a mechanical creature with it.
Yes.
Well, that's an interesting smell. It is an ale brewed with lemons, is what it says on the label. It is a 10% alcohol beer, so it's a pretty substantial kind of beer. It's got all sorts of, like, 100 themed. Like, it's got 100 IBUs, it's got 10% alcohol, which is 10, you know,
right,
put a decimal, 100. It was dry hopped with 100% centennial hops at 100 kilograms per 100 barrel brew length. I'm not even entirely sure what that means.
Yeah, no idea.
It's nice. Mm-hmm. Tastes kind of like an IPA to me.
Definitely. Well, it's because it's 100 IBUs, so.
Yeah, they hopped the shit out of it. Strong. The lemon, I guess I can get a whiff of it. It smells kind of greeny.
I'm not really getting the lemon myself, but.
It's nice. It's pretty good. Well, the mechanical hound was probably the most futuristic element of the book in terms of what we think of as sci-fi. You know, like robots and aliens kind of sci-fi. Other than that, the book...
Well, for him, there's this whole part where his wife wants another big screen TV. And you got to remember in 1953 when this came out that the only TVs were like 7 inches wide. And you know, and so when he's writing it, she wants another wall with a huge, giant, wall-sized TV. Now, for us today, obviously, lots of people have multiple giant TVs in their house.
Sure.
But at the time, that was very futuristic.
And this is, I mean, he's describing a flat-panel TV. You know, mm-hmm. So he's 50 years ahead of the plasma, LCD, whatever TVs. And the Montag is not rich. He's a fireman, right? So he's a civil servant. That he could cover the entire wall with television is pretty damn futuristic.
Mm-hmm.
What they watch on that television really shows how Ray Bradbury felt about the budding medium that was television.
Mm-hmm.
It's garbage. It's like The Family, right, is the show. And it's just people, it just gives the impression that there are people in your house. And kind of like, as if there's something happening and you're kind of part of it, but there's no plot.
Yeah, they mail you the script and you say lines along with the actors in the show. And Montag asks his wife, who's obsessed with this, and that's all she does all day, every day. He asks her, so what's it about? And all she can say is, well, there's this guy. Yeah. I mean, that's really it. It's not about any big theme. It's not about anything important. It's just mindless soap opera type of... I mean, I'm just assuming, because he never actually says it. It's really just a soap opera that she's obsessed with.
It sounds like a total vapid bunch of crap, which it was. Mm-hmm. But probably that's what a lot of television was then, and certainly is now.
Certainly still is.
You know, the cliche that is, you know, 800 channels and nothing to watch. Right? Because most television programming is kind of on the crummy side. It's just, you know, real, especially reality television now, where you could just make a show by filming some person long enough, and then you edit it to give the impression that something important happened. And that's kind of what he's like, rather prescient of reality TV in a sense.
It was.
I mean, it kind of sounds like she's watching The Real World and just hanging out and pretending she's Puck or whatever.
But that's all she does all day, every day.
And she overindulges in sleeping pills.
Right.
So
by accident. This is right near the beginning of the book where his wife takes, like, is literally he gets home. This is like page, you know, 7 or whatever. He gets home and his wife is like dying because she took a whole bottle of sleeping pills, and the guys come, they save her, and they're assholes. But then she doesn't even remember it. And he was only guessing that she wasn't trying to kill herself. She just took 2 and then forgot that she took 2. Because she was so obsessed with their TV show, and they took 2 more, and then took 2 more, and then took 2 more, and then, you know, they had to call the emergency blood people to give her a total blood transfusion.
Which is kind of
sci-fi. Yeah.
Sci-fi. The kind of thing that people probably thought about as that's the future in 1953, right? I mean, I don't know when the first blood transfusions were, but...
I mean, they were already happening.
Yeah, but it wasn't... You know, people say, oh, you can get a pint of blood, why not? Like a whole fresh batch.
Yeah.
And then he sees the blood go in her cheeks and revive her. It's kind of silly now, that part.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't know because her brain has been just turned into, you know, mush from watching television all day and never exercising her brain. She does nothing but watches TV when he goes to work. Sounds like a sweet life. It's pretty sweet.
That's the dream.
So Montag's wife just spends all day watching TV. She doesn't read books because books are banned. Well, how did it get to that point? Right? We talked about the historical influences, right? The Nazis burning books, McCarthy censoring things, calling for people to censor themselves. How did this society ban books?
Well, you only find, in the beginning, Montag doesn't even know. I mean, his job is to burn books, and he doesn't even know this. And eventually, when he starts to question, maybe I should try and read these, his boss, who is the fire chief named Beatty, comes to his house, because he's worried, and explains why books were banned. First, in the beginning, no one even had the attention span for books anymore. All books were cut down to sort of 15-minute versions just so you could read it and sound smarter than other people, sort of the Reader's Digest version of every book, which was crap. But then it actually went a step further, and all books were banned in order to eliminate conflict in society. Because if, you know, you read books, you might think, and the books are going to be filled with contradictory ideas and ideas that might make some people unhappy or other people angry at another group of people. So just all books were banned and outlawed, and all those ideas were outlawed. And if there are no books and nobody knows about this stuff, then there's no conflict in society. And that's really why books were banned.
Which is alarming to me in the fact that I'm sure there are people who, I don't think there's anybody who would say we should ban books, but you go to the early stages of that, and like, well, maybe we should control ideas because we don't want to have people get into conflict over things that they disagree with. Maybe we should just not talk about those things at all.
Or that those few ideas are too dangerous. Let's not let anybody know what those are.
Right. And then the question, you could very quickly, I don't use the slippery slope argument, but it kind of is. And when someone says, oh, well, that idea is dangerous too.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, that one is also dangerous. And then I don't like this idea. I think it's dangerous. And then all of a sudden, then there's nothing. That is an entirely possible thing to me. It seems possible that people who mean well, at least in the beginning, can lead you down to that road. Kind of reminds me of what happens today. There's a lot of free speech issues today.
Yeah, that does appear. That's what happened. Though on the other hand, at least, you know, not in Fahrenheit, but in our world, whenever a book is banned, whenever some group comes out against a book, the book immediately goes on the bestseller list. And banning the book actually just gave it way more publicity. And everyone ends up reading it because it's banned.
I know.
Rather than the ideas going away, you're actually just drawing attention to it. So I think he was wrong about that.
Yeah, I think so. When you ban things, it makes them sexy. Right, it's got this mystique now. Like, oh, why would this be banned?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I remember going to a Barnes & Noble years ago, and there was a table labeled banned books. Obviously not banned anymore, mm-hmm. but it's where I picked up Lolita, because like, oh, this is a banned book. What's this? I like
sexy.
I like, you know, like, this must be really cool. I am a, you know, malcontent. I will like to read this. And it was like Catcher in the Rye, Lolita, probably Huckleberry Finn, maybe, you know, some other, you know, greasier things from the mm-hmm. back in the day. Now I don't think anything really gets banned, except schools will sometimes ban things.
Apparently, Fahrenheit 451 has been not, actually, it probably, I think it has been banned, according to the Wikipedia page, and it's been edited, the publisher edited a version to take out some of the swears, which are the most mild swears in the universe, because he says, like, hell, and he says damn, and he says the word abortion once. So they actually had to edit that and gave it and printed it for like, high schools. And Ray Bradbury received letters, very, you know, ironic letters from students saying, oh, your book was edited to take out the unpleasant parts, which is the exact opposite message of the book itself.
I'm surprised he stood for that. Bradbury...
Well, he didn't. It was done without his even understanding that it was done. And then they changed it.
Yeah, that's some fucking horseshit to bulldozerize, right?
Mm-hmm.
The book to make it safe for children's ears and eyes.
Mm-hmm.
It really missing the point. And shame on those, shame on like the educators who think that, right? Like, this is harmful for the students. We better cut out the bad parts.
Yeah.
I mean, book publishers, I'm almost willing to give them a pass because I feel like they'll just fill any void in the market. Can, like, if there's demand
for it, someone will buy it.
Let's sell it. They want an edited version of it? Awesome. Let's sell that shit. And they probably, I mean, there probably is a decision where they're weighing, will the sales of this supersede the outrage from people on the other side? Because I'm sure, you know, there might be a demand for a Bible that just removes the God character from it. But they probably won't publish that because that would piss off far too many people to make it worth the money. Though, and also the Bible is, you know, there's a lot of different publishers that, but for totally missing the fucking point of the book, that is upsetting to do. Yeah, that's lame. This is totally lame. So, since we're talking about editing the book and reading it in edited or non-edited forms, my question, really, reading this, why should all people read this book?
Well, should all people read this book? I would say yes. Because Bradbury is definitely right. I believe he's definitely right that mass media, such as the television and now the internet, definitely does lead to an element of people not being able to think. Or people not being able to think and not really knowing much except their very, very narrow, knowing much about the world except for their very, very narrow existence, which I would say leads to conflict, whereas Bradbury thought it took away conflict. I think actually it leads to conflict, but
that's a different story. He might have said it would lead to less conflict because everybody would have the same experience through the television. Keep in mind, when the television came out in Bradbury's time, at the time of the book, there were like two channels. So it wasn't like you could change a channel and get a radically different thing. It's not like you can go from Fox News to CNN and get two very different takes on the news. It was just, it was one channel.
NBC Evening News and the CBS Evening News.
Yeah, which were, yeah, and they were damn close to each other in terms of their, I would imagine, they're pretty much identical in coverage in 1953.
And I think they were only like 10 or 15 minutes long.
Yeah.
And it was just, here's a couple things.
And after you get through the cat fashion shows and other stupid puff news stories, there's not much time for editorializing. Whereas now, because, especially with the internet, man, like, you go on YouTube and there's thousands of people who provide content that is tailored to, you know, remarkably small niches. And people then get into that and then they don't ever look outside of it. And that certainly leads to conflict when you kind of become, you know, indoctrinated in one thing. So he didn't see that coming.
But his message that look at how stupid society becomes when we ban books shows why, which is the same question of should people read or should they not? Should they just watch football or should they read? It's the same question.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's a totally fair question because it doesn't have to be either or, right? You could, what the fuck is that guy's name? There's a dude in the NFL right now who's getting his PhD. Like, there,
he just quit?
Oh, really?
He just quit because the study about football players having all this brain damage came out. And he's a PhD candidate in applied mathematics at MIT. And so he's literally at age 26 just quitting the NFL saying, no, I'm not going to do that to my brain. I'm just going to go finish my PhD.
Good for him, man.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Unfortunately, that will not get nearly as much press as the next guy who, like, beats up his girlfriend. Or the next guy who shoots himself in the leg in a strip club in the NFL. Like, we focus on the negative things because it's more entertaining for some reason. It goes down to attention span. And I don't want to sound like a total Luddite. The internet has fucked up my attention span.
Yep.
I think in a world where things are limited to character length now, like not even word length, character length, that strikes me as bizarre that I only have the space to read two lines of text. And I do it all the time with YouTube. I'll open up a video, watch a little bit of the video, and then I'm already losing interest, and I look down on the side of the, you know, recommended or related videos, whatever it's called, and then I'll open them in new tabs, and all of a sudden I have like 27 tabs of videos, and I'll just pause things and jump around, and I'll never watch something in its entirety, even though these things are largely like 5-minute clips of shit. I just bounce around because I get it. That's enough. Fine. I don't have time for this. So there's so much other crap out there I have to see. I can't waste any more time with you.
You know, I watch or listen to everything at 1.5 speed or 2x speed because I can't, regular speed, the speed of a regular person talking is just too slow for me. So, you know, it's because I don't have the attention span, and I think it's totally true.
I go 1.25. I do 1.25 because I watch a lot of stuff with music.
And music sounds weird when you put it at a faster speed. Especially, it's not all music, but whenever there's a vibrato, anything, whether it's a voice or a guitar or whatever, when there's vibrato, then it just sounds weird at a faster speed. The rest of it actually kind of sounds interesting, but...
The voice, 1.25 speed, there I've noticed no difference.
You almost... If you didn't know it was 1.25 speed, 1.25 speed, you wouldn't even realize.
You just think you're watching YouTube videos of all New Yorkers.
Right, yeah.
People were speaking with speed. Speaking of not being able to pay attention to anything, let's try to crack open this other beer. You want to tell us what this is
right?
about?
Right, all right. So the second beer, which is from Threes Brewing. So this beer is called Chronic Myopia. Right, so... myopia means nearsightedness, means inability to see things far away. So it's also, people don't use that term just for being nearsighted. They also is sort of a metaphor for not being able to see the big picture or not being able to see beyond your very narrow existence. In the book, in Fahrenheit 451, the sort of obsession with mass culture and television especially leads people to be mindless, and they have a really terrible case of chronic myopia. All right, so let's
cheers, man.
Oh, I actually just got beer in my computer. Oh boy, just, I'm sorry about that.
That's all good. Unfortunately, since we're just an audio show, you didn't see Nate Steve Austin, that beer can.
I was trying to be dramatic.
That is really piney, and
this is quite strong IPA. Yeah.
Tropical fruit smell. It smells wonderful. It's got a seriously frothy head on there. I did not give it a super vigorous pour.
So
it is delicious.
So
really good. I'm trying to see how much was the alcohol in this sucker. Does it say on here? Oh, just under 7%. But it's quite nice. I've had this before. At their brewery or their brew pub in Brooklyn, but I drank every beer they had, so that night is a blur. Really cool place if you're ever able to check it out.
So another thing, to me, the most sort of important message of the book was the obsession with mindless entertainment. And there's even a passage where Montag and his wife and some of their neighbors are over at their house, and they start talking about politics and just the story about how stupid politics, you know, who you're going to vote for in the next election is just stupid because people just look at it as a TV show. And I guess we're kind of getting into the next question, was he right? Was Ray Bradbury right about the future? And I would say in a lot of ways, yes, he was absolutely right. Because if you look at our culture, we are the culture of United States, 2017. There is really a total obsession with very mindless entertainment, and social media has just made that a lot worse. But I will just say the point about politics is our last presidential election was a reality TV show. And the person that won was the reality TV star. And he is now president, running his administration like a reality TV show. And it's complete mayhem every single week.
Oh, watch out. We're going to alienate some listeners.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, listen, they listen to podcasts, so they're already, you know, NPR.
Some lifties.
Yeah. But am I wrong?
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. we're not in the no spin zone. That's for sure. So it's true. Our political world today is extremely stratified. And just like the other things on the book, people don't have any attention for stuff. So the 24-hour news cycle people talk about, right? It is faster than that at this point. Mm-hmm. It's like an 8.5-hour news cycle. I was away for part of the summer for a week and a half. I missed like fucking four controversies.
He missed four Trump scandals. Just being away for a week and a half.
There are women whose periods have lasted longer than Scaramucci's term as head of the White House. Whatever the fuck he was.
There was one news article that said, "How to lose a guy in 10 days."
I know, that was really good. That's really good. Right, so everything moves at the speed of Twitter, which you can follow us at DrunkGuysBC on Twitter if you're bored.
Yeah.
So Bradbury kind of lays this out. Like, people in the book, they don't even like really remember who they voted for. They don't know. They don't really care. Like, whatever. This is just that's just another show I watch sometimes when I don't want to watch The Family or that stupid thing. People are impatient. People want things to happen instantly, and if it doesn't, we don't have like the follow through to make it happen. People are like, that's not for me. I'll go do something else now.
You know, you would think that with a 24-hour news channels, with multiple 24-hour news channels, with 24 hours to fill, they would fill it with long form, like really long, really deep looks at important policy issues. Nope, they don't. It's just whatever the breaking news cycle is, and then eight talking heads talking about whatever that major thing that just happened in the last 7 minutes was, and that's the entire news cycle. Was Ray Bradbury right? No, he didn't even imagine how bad it was going to be. It's
fair.
Worse than he thought it was going to be.
Well, because, and the reason why is because Bradbury thought there would only be fucking three channels. You know what? I don't know if that's getting picked up, but there is a fire engine going down the street. That is appropriate.
Yeah. Thank you.
He did not imagine a world where we would have this much choice of entertainment. And that's why the society functioned the way it did in the book, where everybody is on the same page. Everybody is equally stupid. Everybody is equally uninformed, and that makes everything fine. There's no conflict now. And you know what? The inverse is true, too. If everybody is equally informed, then you probably wouldn't have conflict either, but informed in the same way, right? Like, if everybody is a scholar on Marx, then they're probably all going to more or less agree. If everybody is a Milton Friedman expert or something, they're going to all want to do that. But the problem is once you can't know everything, and there's where you need a simplified society, because you can't have everybody know everything about every detail about every theory and every book and everything, whatever. That's why we do podcasts like this, to help you not have to read the book.
Right. I mean, we still want you to read the book. Please read the book.
Yeah.
Please read the book.
Yeah, for sure. Though, I think one thing, you know, we go back to the question of should people read this or why should all people read it? Of course, I'll say all people should read it because, one, it's a fun book to read. It's brief. It is one of those things, kind of like when we talk about Catcher in the Rye, a book that people reference more, you know, every once in a while, like the stupid Michael Moore movie.
Oh, yeah, Fahrenheit 9/11.
You know what he's making, what he's referencing there. That's fine. So it's part of our culture to some degree. Not as strong as Catcher in the Rye, but probably unfortunate, but I think it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Should everybody read it? I think at this point in 2017, the people who would read this book, only people who are predisposed to agree with him are going to be changed. You know, if you're a non-reader, would reading Fahrenheit make you a reader? Would that make you be like, oh, I've seen the error of my ways. Let me go pick up some books now that aren't by Dan Brown, which I've read every Dan Brown book. So.
If you're a deep reader, if you really like read it and really get into the themes and his message, but you're not a reader, does that person even exist? Which if you're not a reader, would you really go, oh, I should really read more? You know, even if you did read it and did come to that conclusion, there's still Facebook and Twitter and CNN and so many stupid, mindless entertainment, and our attention span is so short that it probably wouldn't change many people's ideas.
Right, so I think a lot of schools teach this book. A lot of schools have this book, and they're probably in a way to kind of get kids to say, oh, reading is kind of cool. There are some cool shit in the book. People get burned alive. That woman who lights her own match, that is fucking badass.
Yeah.
I can't remember the line. She quotes a thing from a guy who got burnt at the stake in the 1500s, which D.D. recognizes the quote. So that's fucking cool. The mechanical hound scenes, those are cool. But the fable, the moral of the story, if I'm a teenager who's a shitty reader, doesn't like books, am I going to think, wow, books are actually really cool because maybe one day I could be a hobo and read books with them? No, I don't think you're going to be persuaded by it.
Well, in this book, reading books is subversive. It's being, you know, you're being an outlaw by reading books. That's what teenagers want to do.
That is true.
In a way, it makes reading books sexy by making it against the rules. So that's why everyone would want to do it.
That's true. But then the problem is the attention span thing. Because then you might say, oh, reading books is cool. I'm going to go do that. And then you actually have to fucking do it. Because reading is passive.
You have to get past page three.
Is that like a British newspaper reference? Because page three is one with tits on it.
That's not what I was thinking, but that's a good point.
I was in London for about 4 hours, and I managed to find it. Didn't get past page three. Just went right there. Went right to it. I didn't even know what the cover was. Like, oh, that's the one with the tits.
Hello. Page three.
Yeah, so maybe that's how you get people to read. Every three paragraphs, just basically book porn. But I think that already exists. That's already a thing. That's what housewives read. That's
50 Shades of Grey.
Oh my goodness, 50 Shades of Grey. I have not read. Maybe we'll do an episode of 50 Shades of Grey one day.
Listen, we're going to have to, you know, get somebody to sponsor us for that.
Yes, port us and we'll read. Shit, if you pay me, I'll read anything. So, how right was he? I guess pretty damn right.
Except
when he wasn't pessimistic enough.
Yeah, he wasn't pessimistic enough. Now, the other half of his message, which is about censorship, I kind of think he wasn't right about that. Because not only in today's society, if you ban a book, that immediately puts it on the bestseller list, so that doesn't work. If you look at the societies that are incredibly totalitarian, if you look at, you know, the Soviet Union, North Korea, look at China, are those societies anything like Fahrenheit? And they're not. They're very different. And they actively ban books. They actively ban ideas. They have incredible just thought control about what you're supposed to know about and what you're supposed to understand. And it's not, basically, here's my point. This book is much more like Brave New World than it is like 1984.
Right, because North Korea is like 1984 with, you know, our leader, our glorious leader, who we mm-hmm. worship, and we watch a TV show where it's just him riding a horse and whatever, mm-hmm. like that kind of shit. And to question it is not a thing people can perceive, even. So that is very 1984-ish. But Brave New World was all about hedonism and just pleasure and entertainment to distract you from the way the world was fucked up, right? How we conditioned children to not touch flowers because they were not alphas or whatever, they were the epsilons or whatever the hell was.
Mm-hmm.
So reading this book, I think, maybe because I've read a lot of Ray Bradbury's stuff, there's a theme of anti-technology in Bradbury's works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the stuff I've read The Big Bang, Illustrated Man, and Martian Chronicles, and Fahrenheit, and a lot of short story collections, though there's a thread through a lot of his works that technology is a bad thing. It's very rare that technology is a good element in the story. It always leads to something terrible happening somehow. And it can't be any clearer. I don't have the title in front of me of what the short story is from.
Almost the End of the World.
Yeah, Almost the End of the World. Thank you. So Almost the End of the World is a short story in The Day It Rained Forever. And the story tells about two guys who were away. They were like mining or something. They were out of the town for a few days, week or so. They come back and everything is really strange. Like, instantly, as soon as they're back in town, they feel a weirdness. And that they look around, everybody's grass is perfectly cut. The freshly cut lawn. Every hedge is trimmed. Every picket fence is tacky with wet paint. You know, every house shingle is replaced. Like, there's no trash anywhere. You walk past the barber shop and there's a line of guys just waiting to get a shave. Like, they find, what happened? And they say, well, the TV stopped working. We don't have television anymore. And now we just do shit. We're productive again. Right? Now, as a person, whenever I have a day off and I sit around in my underwear watching YouTube videos all day, I totally understand this because I feel like mm-hmm. if I did not have that distraction, there's other shit I would do. I'd go mow the lawn more frequently, or I'd go do things that my wife will be happy, like clean the bathrooms or something. I'd be more productive, but because I have this easy distraction, kind of like in the world of Fahrenheit, I just kind of go for that. But he was, Bradbury was not a fan of television in the 1950s. I don't know if he ever changed his mind later on in life.
Well, there was a really bad movie of Fahrenheit that came out in 1966.
I've never seen it. Have you seen it?
I've seen parts of it.
I heard it was shit. I think they got rid of it, and I'm pouring another little glass of Hellhound on my ale. I gotta say, man, that chronic myopia was really good. Mm-hmm. I think they did cut the mechanical hound out of the movie just because of the limitations technical of sci-fi.
I mean, they didn't have CG at the time, so that would have been very difficult to accomplish.
They had a fucking Muppet. So I heard that was about, and I think the ending was different to that book.
I think in the movie, Clarice, who is the teenage girl at the very beginning, who opens his eyes to how unhappy he is and how society needs to change. In the book, she dies. But in the movie, she just, like, ran away and is with the scholar hobos. So she actually lives.
Right. Well, you know, it is kind of jarring how she dies, because it's off camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't see... Montag gets used to meeting her on his way home from work or whatever, and talking mm-hmm. to her, and he's engaged in what she's saying. She has to go to therapy for thinking differently. She, you know, everybody's worried about
thinking
her.
Differently, which means actually liking to talk to people. Because in this world, wanting to talk to people is being antisocial, not social.
So he gets nervous. He doesn't see her for a few days, and he asks his wife, and she is in such a stupor from her existence of just kind of drug-induced binge-watching mm-hmm. television thing. And she's like, "Oh yeah, she died." She like got hit by a car.
Oh yeah, I think I heard about that. She died.
Yeah, she died. Yeah, they moved away. Yeah. Anyway, and he is shaken. He is moved by this. That's a strong beer. So that's kind of distressing for him. So I don't know. Am I imagining the anti-technology thing in this?
No, it's definitely there. He wants everybody to go back to reading poetry, reading books, reading like very old-fashioned. The point of science fiction itself is to talk about the effect of technology on society. Even like the effect of futuristic technology on society. And that's what he's doing. And his message is, no, it's really pretty bad. This new thing taken to its extreme is pretty bad for society. That's what he's saying.
I think a lot of people feel like that, though. Bradbury died, what, 2012? He was old, man. He mm-hmm. was like 92 or something like that. He saw a lot of changes in his lifetime, right? When he was a child, radio was a pretty new thing. So he went from radio to television through World War II, through the Cold War. Like, he saw the world dramatically change.
Mm-hmm.
That must have, you know, influenced the way he thought about the world. Maybe there's a nostalgia element in his writing, right? He liked the simpler times of the early days when he lived in, Illinois or somewhere. One of the I states he's from. And, sorry, maybe he liked that. Because, sure, who doesn't like a simpler, you know, their younger times? And just because of when he was born, he associated those things with a changing, less pleasant world. So I don't know if his personal life might have influenced his thinking about books, too. About technology.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also a huge bibliophile. Like he learned to write, not by attending, you know, college, but by spending time in the library, and I forget the price, but it was like you'd rent a typewriter and you rented it by the hour, and it was never a nickel or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, cheap to rent a typewriter, and he just wrote and wrote and wrote and surrounded and read and got good at it from just doing it. And so he developed an intense love for books. So I guess his anti-technology is in his writing, especially his writing in the 50s, is got to be a product of a lot of those different forces there.
All right, last question. Is Montag a bitch?
No, he's not. I'd say no. First off, fucking lights a motherfucker on fire. Not a bitch move.
That was badass.
Burns his own house down.
First.
Then he totally goes balls deep into the literature hobo world. I don't think he's a bitch.
He takes his last surviving books, brings them to another fireman's house, and then calls in an anonymous tip so that his house gets burned down. That's badass.
He has the zeal of the converted.
Mm-hmm.
He's really into books all of a sudden. Now he realizes how valuable they are, and he will stop at nothing to return to that world. A world that he doesn't really know anything about.
Nope.
but he has been persuaded.
You know, if you have the courage of your convictions, you're probably not a little bitch. Join us next time.
We'll be reading and drinking about, you might have heard of it, J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
So let us know what you thought about our episode at drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com or
our Twitter is drunkguysbc.
See you next time.
See you next time. Bye.